My sermon is a little shorter in light of the activities of the day. Not short enough to get you out on time. Also, I have managed to leave my reading glasses on my desk. If somebody wouldn't mind heading back there and getting those for me, I would appreciate it. In the Olympics, one of my favorite events is the decathlon, which is 10 very different events in a single competition. So the athletes have to be able to run a sprint, run nearly a mile, high jump, long jump, throw a shot put, hurl a discus, throw a javelin, pole vault, run a hurdles race, and so on. Obviously, it's very difficult to be really good at each of those events separately, and yet that's what these guys are called, these men and women are called on to do. It's why decathlon athletes are often viewed as some of the most well-rounded and talented athletes in all the Olympics, because they have to master all these things. Our passage of Scripture today is kind of like the decathlon, and it's a series of events put together in one chapter that follow one person, Moses, but are events that are vastly different from each other. As an infant, Moses is in danger of being killed. At 3 months, he is put in a reed basket and sent floating down the river. He's found by the daughter of Pharaoh and is raised in the palace. Later on, he kills a man and has to flee for his life. And he winds up in the deserts of Midian tending sheep. And we look at all that and we think, what? That's just all over the map type of topics. It's a series of very different storylines. And so this morning we're going to cover a lot of ground. I'll try to be quick. But Exodus 2 covers a lot of ground. And we probably could have spent a whole sermon on each of those four or five different major events or major topics that happen in this chapter. But in light of the fact that we're not going to spend 2 years in the book of Exodus, we decide occasionally to come across a passage that has lots of stuff jumbled together and treated like a decathlon and covered in one sermon. That's what we get to do today. So first of all, we meet a couple who have a baby, a son. Now, that's probably unusual at that time because all the Israelites knew that Pharaoh had ordered all the Jewish infants to be killed. So this was obviously a very dangerous thing for this baby's parents to do. Another thing to notice is that this couple is pretty ordinary. Their child is going to be used of God to deliver his people from bondage. But Amram and Jochebed, or however you pronounce their names, they're just regular old folk. Just run-of-the-mill, average people. They weren't people of prominence. They weren't people of any great knowledge or skill. They weren't people of privilege or rank. Nothing. And yet, that's who God chose to bear the deliverer of the nation. Were you born of any great position or rank or prominence? Me either. Yet God fully intends to use you and me to change the world. He does. You are His choice to be a light for the gospel in your family, in your workplace, your neighborhood, among your friends. Nothing special about us, just regular folk. But empowered by the Holy Spirit, God makes us into world changers, more than conquerors, ambassadors of the King. Not bad. Well, for Moses' parents, they figured that no earthly authority could tell them to disobey God, including his command to be fruitful and multiply. So that's what they did. And they had a son. Verse 2 tells us, when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. That word beautiful is a Hebrew word that refers to more than just physical beauty. One commentator translates the term as healthy, a healthy baby. Whatever it was about little baby Moses, his parents clearly recognized that he was special. So they went to special measures to protect him. Jochebed kept Moses hidden for 3 months. But the time inevitably came when she could conceal him no longer, so she put him in a wicker basket and sent him down the Nile River. She chose a material that would float, but she wanted it more than just able to float. She needed it waterproof for her baby inside, and so they covered it with tar and pitch. And then she put her baby boy in that basket and it went down the banks of the river, she went down to the banks of the river and set it in the water, and she watched her baby float away. Imagine there was a whole lot of praying going on for this heartbroken woman who had to take such drastic action to save the life of her child. But what a step of faith that God would take care of this beautiful little baby boy. I don't know that we really have much of a parallel to that in our culture today. I suppose on a much smaller scale, maybe sending your child off to college. Well, the day when you hand them over to their bride or their groom for marriage, they're embarking on life, a new life in college as adults. They're embarking upon new life together as they're joined to their husband and wife and cleaved to one another. But really, there really is nothing quite like what Jochebed had to do with Moses. Those were very desperate times, and she knew that she simply had no choice. God would have to take care of her baby. So she put him in a basket and watched him float away down the river. But who does God use to help save this child? It's Moses' big sis. Verse 4 says, his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. So she followed the basket as it floated down the Nile, probably hiding behind bush and shrub and stuff, because she wanted to know what happened, and she wanted to make sure she wasn't noticed in the process. By the way, the Hebrew word for basket here is the same word that's used in the book of Genesis for the ark, for Noah's ark. Same idea. A big handmade floating boat type thing with people on board being protected in the water. This was Moses' little ark. So Moses' big sister, we assume it's Miriam, since she's the only sister that's mentioned by name in the Bible for Moses. Moses' big sister followed the basket floating down the Nile, and she saw that it was discovered by the daughter of Pharaoh. And this Pharaoh would be Thutmose the First. Now, you know, if you're a betting person, the odds of the daughter of Pharaoh, out of all the Egyptian women who would go down to the Nile, and her bathing in the Nile at exactly that moment when this basket's floating by, the odds of that are pretty small. Except God obviously had his sovereign hand over all of this, as we'll continue to see throughout the chapter. But don't you love how you can be facing some situation where the odds are so stacked against you? But it just doesn't matter. You're a child of God, and God's got this. It never matters what the odds are. God is greater. God is a great God. He's all-powerful, all-knowing. He loves you with an everlasting love, and he has a perfect plan for your life, for every one of us. It never matters what the odds are. So the daughter of Pharaoh discovers this baby in a reed basket floating down the Nile. Now here's a remarkable but often forgotten miracle in all this. Verse 6. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying, and she had pity on him. And says in the text that she recognized that it was the child of one of the Hebrew women. But she had pity on him. Now she's fully aware that dear old dad, the king, has authorized every Egyptian person to kill any male Hebrew child. And so she or any one of her attendants could have killed baby Moses right on the spot. But she had pity on him. God had moved in her heart to have compassion on this little three-month-old baby, a baby that, according to the command of Pharaoh himself, should have been dead. So Big Sis comes along and says, and takes the initiative and walks up to Pharaoh's daughter of all people and says, shall I go and get a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you? Sure, go ahead, she says. So she goes and she gets Moses' own mother, Jochebed. Again, what are the odds? But God sovereignly stepped in and saw to it that Moses was cared for by his own birth mother. Then the time came when she had to bring Moses to Pharaoh's daughter and for him to be raised in the palace. The Egyptian princess adopted the baby as her own, and she named him Moses. We don't quite realize it's actually Pharaoh's daughter who gave him the name Moses. It wasn't Amnon and Jochebed. And she says she gave him that name because, in verse 10, because I drew him out of the water. The name Moses is actually a derivation of some of the great pharaohs of Egypt. Amos, A-H-M-O-S-E, and Thutmose, T-H-U-T-M-O-S-E, and so on. So maybe that specific Mos, M-O-S-C, part of the name helped Pharaoh accept this Hebrew boy in his home. I don't know. It doesn't tell us. But having commanded all of the Hebrew boys to be killed, to now having one come live with him in the palace, that's quite a leap. A leap possible, again, by God's sovereign plan. So let's just step back a minute and put all this in perspective. Pharaoh has ordered, in the previous chapter, ordered all of the Hebrew male children to be killed. And they're being slaughtered right and left by the hundreds, by the thousands. But one is found floating down the river by his own daughter, and that Hebrew boy is raised in Pharaoh's own palace. And then that same Hebrew boy would grow up in the palace and is going to be the one that God chooses to bring horrific plagues upon the land, and will be used by God to destroy Pharaoh's own army as they drowned in the sea. The one Hebrew boy that Pharaoh brought in or allowed in is the one Hebrew who would destroy him. Can you write a script like that? It's just incredible. Now, in the palace of the king, of course, Moses enjoyed all the highest privileges of his position, the best education, the best food, housing, clothing. He was raised to be a leader of men. He was able to enjoy the best life possible in Egyptian culture. But he was also still a Jew, and he knew it. And he cared deeply about the plight of his people. And so the day came when his two worlds collided, his Jewish heritage and his Egyptian privilege. And I called this section or this point rash in the streets, and I don't mean by that like a skin rash. I mean, later on, there's going to be all these 10 plagues. You're going to get plenty of rashes and stuff. That's not this. Here I mean that Moses is about to act rashly, hastily, impulsively, recklessly. Now, we don't know from the book of Exodus if Moses ever visited his countrymen there in that portion of Egypt known as Goshen or not. We're never told if, you know, I mean, as Pharaoh's daughter, or as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, he could have gone wherever he wanted. So, but we're just not told. Did he know what was going on? Did he have oversight of any of that? Was he involved in any of that? We're not told. And so we go to another passage. The answer to that is given in a speech by a guy about to be stoned to death some 1,500 years after the time of Moses. Acts chapter 7, Stephen is giving a defense of his faith. And he goes to the various patriarchs, and then he finally comes to Moses and gives a very intriguing representation of who Moses was and what Moses went through. And as I read this, I want to pause for just a moment and remind us it's very important to understand how the New Testament views the Old Testament. Because you hear a lot of people out there in the world today thinking, well, it's just a bunch of myths and legends and fanciful stories and none of this really happened, but it's in the Bible just so that, you know, you'll feel good or it'll inspire you to be a better person or make good choices or help your fellow man, stuff like that. But it didn't really happen that way. It wasn't like, you know, God parted the Red Sea and they walked on dry land and stuff. This, you know, it wasn't like the Balaam's donkey actually talked. We don't really believe those things. You know, three guys in a fiery furnace and they didn't get sins. I mean, what's going on? They're nice lessons, but they're not actual true events. Well, one of the ways that we know that they're true, in addition to the fact that God wrote this, is how the New Testament views those events in the Old Testament. So when Stephen presents this to us, is he going to describe it as, you know, there's this wonderful, fanciful, mythical story from Moses who's putting a little reed basket floated down the Nile all nice and calm. And Pharaoh's daughter, of all people, found this and brought it into the palace. But, you know, it didn't really happen that way. It's just a nice story of, you know, God cares for us. He watches over us. And no, listen very closely to how Stephen describes the life of Moses. This is what he says. It was at this time that Moses was born, and he was lovely in the sight of God, and he was nurtured 3 months in his father's home. And after he had been set outside, set in the little basket, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds. We'll come back to that phrase in a future sermon. When Moses, confronted by God at the burning bush, says, I can't talk. Not me. I'm poor of speech. Talk to my brother Aaron, okay? I'm not the right man for this. Well, turns out, he was actually being trained by the best educators that all of Egypt had. He was a man of power in words and deeds. He's just making excuses. He didn't want to be leading this whole thing until God finally gets a hold of him. But very intriguing. Then it goes on to say, but when he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. So we gather from that he never really ventured over into Goshen, never really taken a look to see what was happening there. And so finally, after, you know, 40 years old, he decides to make the trip, and that's when he came across this episode of an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. And of course, Moses knew that he was Hebrew himself, and so that meant that he and this man that was being beaten right in front of him were brethren. They're of the same people. And watching him get beaten really hit Moses hard. Maybe he hadn't seen that kind of abuse before. Maybe it was just a particularly cruel beating. It doesn't really say. Whatever the case, Moses had seen enough, and he took matters into his own hands. And of course, you know, he's the son of the Pharaoh's daughter, right? He's raised in a palace. He can do whatever he wants, right? Well, in his own heart, he knows that this is wrong. What he's about to do is wrong. And so we read in verse 12, he's looking around, see if anybody's watching. He's checking to see, is it safe? You know, is this going to be okay? Because he doesn't want to get caught. He knows he's about to do something wrong. So thinking that he's now safe, not going to be discovered, he struck the Egyptian and killed him and then buried him in the sand to cover it all up. Well, Moses, of course, was not as secretive as he had thought. So the next day, the whole thing is exposed in verse 13. He went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And Moses said to the offender, why are you striking your companion? But he said, who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you had killed the Egyptian? Oops. So Moses realized that what he had done the day before had been seen by someone, and word had spread of this murder. So verse 15, very important. You know, we tend to think of, okay, Moses killed this guy. It's been found out. It was pointed out to him. It's now known. He just immediately hightailed it out of there and headed off as far as he could get, right? Verse 15 says there's some other detail that's really worth noticing. It says, when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. And you would have thought that the Pharaohs and their families could pretty much do whatever they wanted. I mean, it's Pharaoh, it's his family. But the murder of an Egyptian for something as insignificant as beating a lowly Hebrew, I mean, that was too much. Pharaoh's reaction was so severe that he now wanted Moses dead. So it's worth noting this is a different Pharaoh than the one who'd ordered the murder of all the Hebrew male babies 40 years earlier. In fact, it's probably his grandson. So maybe while the original Pharaoh got to where he liked Moses and gave him every privilege and advantage there in the palace, it's quite likely that this Pharaoh grew up with Moses and viewed him as a threat. So first chance he got, he wants Moses out of the way. And so Moses fled and settled in the land of Midian, where he spent the next 40 years. Midianites, by the way, are descendants of Abraham through Keturah. Midian is off to the east, so Moses traveled from where he was in Egypt, across the Sinai Peninsula into what is now modern-day northern part of Saudi Arabia. And there he met these seven daughters of local priests who were trying to draw water for their father's flock. And, of course, some shepherds had come by and were you know, elbow them out of the way and saying, you know, we're going first and not giving the ladies a turn and just, you know, being stubborn men and all that. So turns out Moses was there that day, and he put a stop to all that harassment and got the ladies to water for their flocks that they needed. Verse 18. When they came to Reuel, their father, so they've gotten all the water and they're heading back home, he said, why have you come back home so soon today? And they said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock. He said to his daughters, where is he then? Why is it you left the man behind? Invite him to come have something to eat. Now, just to clear things up, this man Reuel, or however you pronounce that, is actually the same person that we know more commonly as Jethro. That's the name that is more readily used throughout the scriptures, the father-in-law of Moses. One name may have been a title, the other name may have been perhaps a first name, but it is the same person. He's one father-in-law. A single verse later, we find Moses married to Reuel's daughter Zipporah, and then verse 22 says, then she gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. We read that and we tend to think, oh, he's just kind of chronicling how his life has gone. You know, here I am, I'm a sojourner in a foreign land. Well, truth is, Moses really is not a happy camper. He's not. The name Gershom actually means banishment. So imagine being so bothered by your fate, which you brought upon yourself, that you name your firstborn child banishment. hey, banishment. Could you bring me another piece of pie? Hey, banishment, could you go fix the fence out back? Hey, banishment, how about another blanket for your dear old man? Banishment. You know, a lot of people run away from their problems, but that does not mean that things always turn out rosy. Typically, all that you've done is trade one set of trouble for another. If you were involved in experiencing misery before, then that misery tends to follow you wherever you go, unless you're ready to make some hard choices about the kind of person you're willing to be and how you're going to live your life. Otherwise, you just repeat the same old mistakes and experience the same old consequences. We tend to picture Moses as just, you know, having a great life, great time in his new life in Midian. He's got a lovely wife, he's got a child, he's got responsibilities, he's developing some flocks and herds, he seems to be doing just fine. That wasn't the case. Moses' troubles in Egypt followed him in that his heart was weighed down by the consequences of his actions, to the extent that he named his firstborn son Banishment. And he was reminded of his past failures every single time he spoke his own child's name. He simply couldn't escape his past. Well, the focus on Moses ends at this point, and chapter 2 concludes with the return to Egypt and the focus on the Israelites in bondage. It says, "Now it came about in the course of those days that the king of Egypt died." So the Pharaoh who had tried to kill Moses for killing the Egyptian, that Pharaoh's now dead, and there's a new Pharaoh on the throne. It says, "And the sons of Israel sighed," or grieved, or mourned because of their bondage, and they cried out. And their cry for help because of the bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. I love how God is attentive to his people, how he hears the cries of our heart. The Israelites were suffering in their captivity, suffering under the weight of their workload, suffering under the cruel hand of their taskmasters. And so they cried out to God, and God heard them. God remembered them. And it wasn't that he'd forgotten them, but in his sovereign plan, God waited until just the right moment when the people were crying out and seeking God for help and intervention. The people of Israel were finally at a point of true desperation, and God heard their cries. God took notice. You ever felt really desperate in some situation? Really desperate? I love how God hears the cries of his people from our point of desperation, from our point of deepest pain and greatest fear. God hears. But he also hears the everyday, ordinary, mundane prayers for God to bless our day, or bless our food, or watch over our families, and so forth. But in those moments of deep desperation, know that God hears. He's near you. He hears every word, every whisper, every tearful plea for help. He hears. You, his child, have his full attention. God hears. A deliverer has been born. God has sovereignly watched over Moses' life from birth on. God is preparing his deliverer. He's not a perfect man. He killed a guy as he rashly lashed out in rage. But God takes imperfect, broken vessels, and he uses them mightily. He takes imperfect, broken vessels like you and me, and he's ready to do something mighty, something world-changing through us, if we'll listen, if we'll follow, if we'll obey. Otherwise, we might need to spend some time on the backside of the desert. Let's pray.